Well, this goes to whether or not the structure of the government, the constitutional structure, is strong enough to withstand people who wish to overgo their power. And it brings to mind that the President Obama has done so repeatedly with executive orders on immigration, on coal rules, on all sorts of things. But he's been put back by the Supreme Court. That is, I guess you're saying you have confidence that a President Trump cannot be more authoritarian than a President Obama has been.
Yeah, I mean, the system is bigger than any of us, including the president. And as you point out, no president has pushed the limits more than Barack Obama. And people who are outraged by some of the things that Donald Trump says and are afraid he's going to push the limits too far ought to look at the current occupant of the White House. I mean, he has done it on virtually every issue. The most conspicuous example would be the immigration executive orders he issued after the 2014 drubbing that his party took in the midterm election. After saying on numerous occasions he didn't have the authority to do any of that. Now, the courts have temporarily stopped that. I hope they'll permanently stop it. But the courts are there to make sure that we all play by the rules.
Now, you are, I would really love to see you and Paul Ryan work with a Republican president, President Trump. I think a lot could get happen, but your majority is in danger. You have Senator Ayotte, Senator Toomey, Senator Portman, Senator Johnson. You got an open seat in Florida. You've got maybe Joe Heck okay in Nevada. The Colorado seat may come into play. I put on Senators Ayotte, Toomey, and Portman Johnson in a regular rotation to try and get them attention and money. But what's your thought about keeping the majority that this book, The Long Game, makes clear you've been working to be the leader of for six terms?
Well, it's a tricky election. It would have been, no matter who the nominee for president was, we have 24 seats up. The Democrats only have 10. And you mentioned all of the places where we expect to have tight races: New Hampshire, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Wisconsin, Illinois, Nevada, and Florida. And therein lies the majority. One of the things that I'm hoping, I and my colleagues have been trying to convince Senator Marco Rubio to run again in Florida. He had indicated he was not going to, but we're all hoping that he'll reconsider, because poll data indicates that he is the one who can win for us. It would not only save a terrific senator for the Senate, but help save the majority.
Are you making progress in that regard?
Well, I hope so. We're all lobbying hard for him to run again. He's been back in the Senate for 6 weeks. He's, I believe, enjoying it and being effective. Fortunately, Florida has a very late filing deadline, sometime in June, and a late primary in August. And so one of the current candidates in Florida has already indicated he would drop out if Marco decided to run again. So I haven't given up hope. He hasn't said yes yet, but there are an awful lot of us who think that it would not only be good for him and for Florida, but good for the Senate if he ran again.
A lot of people are touting one of your colleagues, I mentioned him earlier, Tom Cotton, as a vice presidential running mate for Donald Trump, who would bring national security chops, experience in combat, youth, vigor, you know, an interesting state for some diversity. What do you make of that idea?
Tom is an outstanding senator, you know, combat veteran of Iraq, very, very smart, and one of a number of the class of 14 that actually ended up finally making me the majority leader that, you know, have big futures ahead.
You write in the Long Game that you spend 80% of your time with 20% of your members. It's really one of the funnier parts of the Long
rule.
Game. 80-20 rule. Is Cotton part of the 20, or is he part of the 80 that you can leave alone for a while?
No, Cotton is part of the 80.
Okay. It's a very funny book. I got to tell you, you must have written this, because I've interviewed you dozens of times, and your voice comes through in here very, very wry at points.
I did. You know, look, the 80-20 rule, in case your viewers don't, think of men's ties. The 80-20 rule says that you'll wear 20% of your ties 80% of the time. And obviously, 80% of your ties, you will only wear 20% of the time.
Correct.
Same applies to the Republican conference. I spend 80% of my time with 20% of my members. Yeah. You know, the ones who are the hardest to get on board. And the last thing you want, by the way, is for more people in the 80 to go over to the 20, which that makes your, your challenge is even greater.
Well, you tell the story.
The 80-20 rule is just one of life's rules that applies to a whole lot of things we all do.
It applied to Arlen Specter. Now, I supported Arlen Specter and took a lot of heat for it when he got challenged by Pat Toomey the first time. And then he went and he did the big bounce like Jeffords did on us. And, you know, he didn't talk to you beforehand. Was he afraid you'd talk him out of it?
Oh, look, you know, Arlen started off as a Democrat. I think his ambitions were related to getting ahead and not so much to philosophy. He was frequently not with us. He was certainly one of the 20 percent.
I thought so. I thought
required
so.
A lot of attention, and even then, only rarely was helpful. And I think, you know, I told him when he called me up and said he was going to switch to the Democrats because that was the only way he could win. I said, "Arlen, this is the only thing you're ever going to be known for." And then, in one of the great ironies of his life, it didn't work. He switched to the Democrats and couldn't win the primary.
He is also remembered for helping confirm Clarence Thomas, his finest hour in the Senate.
It was his finest hour, in my opinion.
Yeah, and you now have a very fine hour of the Republicans in the Senate holding on no hearings, no votes. And I want to salute you for doing that. I don't know that any conservatives have given you the credit due you. They love to beat you up, Senator McConnell. I'm sure you know that better than I know it. They love to beat you up on the radio and on television. But here you've pulled off the most disciplined and principled important objective, because if the court goes, I mean, if Hillary wins, she gets it. But if she doesn't, the court has a shot of staying center right. So my hat is off to you on that. Has anyone written, have your critics noted that very often, that you've pulled that off?
Well, it's been a pretty popular decision with some of my critics. And Fred Barnes in the Weekly Standard just the other day had a nice column about it. I think it's pretty widely accepted that was the right thing for us to do. Look, I mean, you've talked about this a lot, and I know your no hearings, no votes advocacy on the air, and you and I are right about this. I mean, you know, to allow this president in the 11th hour on the way out the door to turn the court to the left for the next generation was simply not going to happen. And, you know, one thing I knew is that the shoe was on the other foot. If this was a Republican president making this nomination in the middle of a presidential year to a Democratic Senate, they wouldn't confirm him. So I knew how it was going to end. You know, been 80 years since a vacancy created in a presidential election year was confirmed. You have to go back to Grover Cleveland to find the last time a vacancy created in a presidential election year was confirmed by a Senate of the opposite party. So we knew he wasn't going to be confirmed. So the question was, how do you deal with that? And I thought it was better to make it a matter of principle, which is that we're in the middle of the election. The next president should fill this vacancy and not make it about the person.
Very well done. The long game also gave me some insight as to where you developed some of these principles. I did not know you had worked for the great Lawrence Silberman, along with Bork and Scalia, over at the Office of Legislative Affairs. I clerked on the D.C. Circuit in 83 when Scalia and Bork and Silberman were all there. And so you were hanging out with the greatest legal minds the conservative movement had produced.
Yeah, I was afraid to open my mouth. I sat there quietly in the middle of all that genius. But they were all in the department at the same time during the Ford administration when I was, down in the Office of Legislative Affairs. And the brilliance every morning at staff meetings I could observe. It was breathtaking. You know, three of the greatest minds in conservative judicial history. And they were all there in the same department.
That's what I love about memoirs, is that you pick up part of the story you never got before. I had known about the Bloodhound ads, and I want to go there now because I want to promise people the long game is hilarious. I mean, it actually is very funny how the Roger Ailes made that ad. And if you just touch a little bit on it, we don't want to give away the whole game to the long game, but that is a funny story.
Yeah, well, You know, it was a desperate situation. Roger had agreed to do my campaign. I don't think he realized what an uphill slog it was going to be. It was July of 1984. We're about 4 months before the election. I'm over 30 points behind. We have a strategy meeting in Louisville, my office. And I said, Roger, is this over? He said, well, I can't recall a campaign this far behind this late that ever won. but he said, it's not over. And so we, you know, we kept looking for a needle in a haystack. I was running against a popular two-term Democratic incumbent. And we found that this was back when you could still make speeches for money, honoraria, which I didn't have any problem with as a matter of principle, but he was missing votes on the floor of the Senate to make speeches for money. So Ailes came up with these ads that had a hunter with a bunch of bloodhounds out looking for Huddleston to get him back to work. And it was humorous, well done. People started paying attention to the campaign. It lit it up. And, you know, we everything else we had done just had no impact. That people were, believe it or not, 1984 was morning again in America. Everybody was in a good mood. Nobody wanted to fire anybody. And we had, Ailes came up with a sequel. We actually had a second Bloodhound Edge where we had an actor that dressed up like the incumbent Huddleston.
Snarfy.
Chased him through the fields, and he actually ended him up a tree. They literally treed him. He said, we got you now, D. Huddleston. The point I'm making is this was a year so different from the year we're in now. Everybody was in a good mood. Nobody wanted to fire anybody. And even though Reagan carried 49 out of 50 states, only one Democratic incumbent senator in the whole country lost that day, the guy I was running against.
Now, the sad part is, if Ailes made the ad today the way he made it in 1984, when he brought the bloodhounds to Congress, all those dogs would be shot. No one can get near Congress. We live in a different world right now.
Yeah, he wouldn't have been able to get on the Capitol grounds.
No, he just unleashed a dog with no permit. He went up and filmed it. That's an amazing story. But there's a lesson in the long game. When you start talking about the Fancy Farms Picnic, which began in 1880, I'd never heard of it, or the Tobacco Festival in Logan County, or the other Catholic picnics in Eastern Jefferson County, or the Sorghum Festival, whatever sorghum is, in Morgan County, or Hillbilly Days in Pikeville, you have to work to win. I mean, you got to work every day. And I think a lot of young people who are used to Twitter don't get that retail politics is what wins races.
Well, I think it's still important. It's still important. Look at how much, of course, Trump hadn't done this yet, but look at how much time presidential candidates even spend on building infrastructure. This is actually door-to-door stuff still today.
Are you worried that Donald Trump has not done that, Senator McConnell?
Well, the RNC is doing it, and I think that will happen before before the general election. But during the primaries, no. I mean, he didn't. I mean, he won this thing with tweets and rallies. Very different.
Very different.
Lots of the other candidates were spending time doing this sort of thing. But
tweets, rallies, and television, not to mention a lot of radio. He is omnipresent on the media, and he is that combative character that we talked about earlier, kind of Newt on steroids from 2012. He's really taken it up a notch. But he does have some people worried. We'll come back to that. I want to stay on the 84 campaign. Another lesson I took from this, every campaign has high days and low days, and you got to laugh because President Reagan referred to you as my good friend Mitch O'Donnell, and Vice President Bush referred to you to Mayor McConnell, the mayor of Louisville. Those are not good things.
It was just one indignity after another, and it underscored they didn't know who the hell I was. And so, you know, it was one of the bigger surprises in the country that I ended up winning that night. It was not exactly a landslide, about one vote a precinct. But, it was a tough slog. And a lot of times life is a tough slog. And I think there's a lesson in that for all of us, that if you just don't give up and keep your nose to the grindstone and keep on working, it's amazing what can sometimes happen, which is, of course, what my mother did with me in recovering from polio.
Now, I want to finish with two subjects. One is Kentucky and the other is the Senate. I learned a lot about Kentucky in reading The Long Game, and I've known about Henry Clay, and I've known about your great tradition as a border state. But I didn't know it was 92% white and 7% African-American, and I didn't know it swung the way that it swung. In the course of your career, you've had real tight races, and then you blew out Allison Grimes. I mean, you blew her out after they threw everything at you in a year that was not good for Republicans. Why did it? I mean, you did win the Senate in 2014, but it was supposed to be a tough year. Why did that happen? I was down there about a week before with Carly Fiorina. We did an event together, and you had a good crowd, and you were working, but no one saw 110 out of 120 counties coming.
Well, I think we ran a good campaign. I mean, I was, by the way, targeted in the primaries for being some kind of Obama enabler by a group called the Senate Conservatives Fund, which, in my view, had cost us about five Senate seats in 2010 and 2012 by helping to nominate people who couldn't win in November. They did it in Delaware. They did it in Colorado. They did it in Nevada in 2010. And in 2012, they did it in Missouri and in Indiana. And so in 2014, I said, you know, we're not going to do this anymore. We're going to nominate people who can actually win the election everywhere. And that guaranteed I got a big primary. But fortunately, I think, handled that rather well. I carried 118 out of 120 counties and won by 30 points. And the guy I was running against was no slouch. He's now the governor of Kentucky. He came back and got elected governor the next year. And then in the general, as you indicated, I was a focal point of the left. So in the course of the year, we dealt with both the right and the left. What's the lesson? Good campaigns like I ran in high school by, you know, getting endorsements from people that the kids in school knew can affect the outcome.
And so, also helps to have wonderful daughters. And Elaine is a wonderful. I didn't know that Elaine had been the director of the Peace Corps, as is my best friend in life, Mark Guerin. I didn't realize she'd done that, but she's got to be quite an asset on the campaign trail as well.
Yeah, Elaine is a really good speaker. She's had a public career herself as Secretary of Labor during the Bush 43 years, and as you indicated, was Director of Peace Corps during Bush 41, part of that time. And good speaker, enjoys campaigning, people like her, and she would keep her own schedule, and that was a huge, huge help to me as well.
Now, what I don't understand is how you can enjoy. I know you're a Louisville Cardinal through and through. I didn't quite get how thoroughly a Louisville Cardinal you were until I read the book, The Long Game. But you're at every single home game that you can be at a cookout. Do people leave you alone and let you enjoy that? Or are you campaigning every day you're outside Papa John Stadium?
Well, I'm not campaigning, but I don't try to avoid people either. Yeah, people come over. They're generally nice, and I am about the Louisville Cardinals like you are about the Cleveland Browns.
Yep.
Only we've done better than you guys have lately.
Well, we picked the Kentucky quarterback. That was, yeah. Oh, God bless Tim Couch. I don't want to blame it on Couch. It was not his fault.
Yeah, sorry about that. But he went to Kentucky anyway. No, I love it. I mean, we go out. I've got a friend with an RV. I buy season tickets, 12 season tickets every year, and have some regulars, one of whom goes back to my time in college. And we go out there a couple hours before the game, go to the game a couple hours after the game, make a whole day of it. I rarely miss a home game. And one year I went to every game, home and away, but one. So, yeah, I'm a serious college football fan, particularly Louisville Cardinals.
You're also a serious defender of the Senate. Hey, I want to thank you for including a defense of the Electoral College in the long game, which you're right. We would have Bush v. Gore every year if we didn't have the Electoral College. I've never made that argument before. I always made the argument of diversity and empowering different parts of the country to have a voice because the Electoral College, we'd never see a president in Kansas if it didn't have electoral votes.
Yeah, there's been a lot of elections that were close nationwide in terms of popular vote. The Electoral College guarantees you have finality in 50 different places. If you didn't have finality in 50 different places, just look at 2000.
No, that's a brilliant argument.
We'd have been recounting in every precinct in America. We wouldn't have been able to finish the recount before the inauguration the next January 20th.
No, it's actually an argument I had never seen before, and I've been reading this stuff for years, so my hat is off to that. But on the Senate, you obviously like a kind of senator. I used to say my favorite senator was John Kyle, and now you've got a great leadership team in Cornyn and Thune, and you have the same kind of temperament that people are not elected to the Senate to get everything they want. They've got to be very patient. They've got to play the very long game. Is that who's been coming in? Now, I don't want any fights started here, but nowadays, the kind of campaigns that win are campaigns that can raise a lot of money by direct mail, get a lot of tweets about them, mobilize third-party funds, and you write about these faux conservative funds that are a cancer on the Republican Party, as Matt Lewis has done, people who are making money off of campaigns that aren't actually going to the candidates. Has the nature of the Senate changed because the way you get elected in America has changed?
No. It has had a huge impact in the House, but I think in the Senate we've only got a couple of members. Everybody else is what I would call in the constructive caucus. And I think even though we're in an impatient society, once you get to the Senate, if you're not comfortable with imperfection, you're going to have a hard time because nobody gets exactly what they want. The Senate was constructed in such a way that nothing happens quickly. And so impatience is not rewarded in terms of success in the Senate. Now, if you don't want to stay there and you just want to use it as a launching pad for president, like President Obama did, that's fine. President Hillary Clinton did the same thing. Basically, she was just going to be there for a while. But I think most senators probably realize they're not going to be president. And if you want to be successful in the Senate and accomplish things for the country and for your state, patience and a long game are exactly what you ought to play.
You also write a defense of the Republican Party. We are the party of I say we because I am a lifetime Republican. Abolitionism, the Homestead Act, land-grant universities, women's suffrage, the Civil Rights Act of 1964. You were very disappointed in Goldwater that we got you motivated into politics when he did not support the Civil Rights Act of 1964. We are for public infrastructure that's generally Hamiltonian, like ports and roads and stuff like that. But does the Republican Party have an identity crisis? Because Donald Trump said he's going to change the nature of the party, Senator McConnell. And I don't know much. You know, if I come around to supporting him, it'll be because of that Supreme Court and because he's going to rebuild the military. But I'm not sure he's bought into the historical limited government theory. Do you?
Well, whether he has or not, he's not going to change the Republican Party. You know, we've had nominees before who were not deeply into Republican politics and philosophy. Think of Eisenhower, for example. But Trump is not going to change the institution. He's not going to change the basic philosophy of the party. And I'm comfortable voting for him because on the big things that I think have the greatest impact on the future of the country, at the top of the list, the Supreme Court, I think you'll be just fine.
All right, let me close by asking you about John Sherman Cooper. I think I know his grandson pretty well. I think he's on the Nashville City Council now, John Cooper. You say he was the first truly great man I'd met. What does that mean? What's a great man?
Well, you know, I was 22 years old, and other than my dad, who I greatly admired, who I think by any objective standard was not be considered by most people a great man. I just hadn't been in the presence of anybody of his stature and accomplishment. And so he was a huge role model for me. He ended up having a different path in the Senate. He ran for leader and was defeated by Everett Dirksen. So I don't know what Cooper's career would have been like had he become Republican leader of the Senate. He was a highly independent guy. He was by any objective standard, a pretty liberal Republican, which I'm certainly not, but I like the way he did the job. I like the integrity, the intelligence. He was an extraordinary influence on my early political life.
Now, I want to close by asking you about Democrats. I will note that you come from County Down, as do the Hewitts from Saintfield, and so you ought to be a Democrat. I mean, you're a Piedmont Ulsterman, and you ought to be a Democrat, but you're a Republican. But you know Democrats, obviously, and you've got a lot of them to vote for you over the years. Of all the Democrats you have served with, who have you admired the most on the other side of the aisle?
Well, I think from a leader point of view, I think George Mitchell, who is a very skillful, articulate Democratic leader, very different from the current Democratic leader in terms of his use of the language and his skill in nailing you in subtle ways. He did a lot to make Bush 41 a one-term president. So Mitchell, I think, was very, very effective. And, you know, one of the others would say this too, but it'd be hard not to be impressed with Ted Kennedy.
You know, you occupy his office now. I didn't know that.
Yeah, you know, even though he was a Kennedy, and you expect all Kennedys to be in the middle of everything, the fact that he decided not to seek the presidency and to play the long game in the Senate ended up carving a niche for himself, very different from his brothers and different from what people expected. So even though we agreed on almost nothing.
He sought the presidency in 76 and failed. Did that change him? That's before your time, but did that change him?
Well, it was in 80, actually. 80,
excuse me.
He challenged Carter in the primaries before me. But, for a Kennedy to decide not to seek the presidency again, I thought was an interesting decision. And he ended up devoting himself to the institution and to the causes he believed in. And I think that's the sort of thing that I personally can identify with.
And a very last question. Chuck Schumer is a deal maker. And so the new Senate, and I hope you return as the majority leader, will have Schumer opposite you, whether you're majority or minority, and we'll have Paul Ryan up. I don't know if Nancy Pelosi is going to be around again. Who knows? But could we be on the cusp of an era of getting rid of Obamacare, which you devote some very necessary pages to describing what a disaster it is, and now people are getting their premium checks and the deductibles are going up, and they understand they can't see doctors, they can't get into plans, it's a collapse. You're right, the worst bit of legislation ever. Are we on the cusp of an era where we might get some stuff done that needs to be done as opposed to shuffling papers and meaningless gestures?
It'll need a president willing to sign Obamacare repeal, and that's another reason I'm voting for Donald Trump. On the big issue of entitlement eligibility, Trump is not there yet. I hope he will get there. That's absolutely essential if we're going to save the country. Both Medicare and Social Security, our most popular entitlement programs, have to be changed in such a way to fit the demographics of America tomorrow and not the demographics of America in the 30s and the 60s. Those are the mega issues confronting the country, as well as tax reform.
And the DOD rebuild.
The key is going to be who's in the White House, not whether Schumer will be cooperative.
But he will get the military rebuilt. I believe him on that. I believe he'll find the money on that. The filibuster, though, remains in a state of semi-destruction. Are you going to rebuild that, or are you going to leave it suspended for a Republican president to at least match the number of judges the Dems rammed through when the nuclear option came down?
Yeah, I'm not going to give you a definitive answer on that, but if we had a Republican president, the results of the nuclear option, whether we liked it, the fact that it was done or not, would help a Republican president fill lots of vacancies in the courts.
Senator McConnell, I've taken an hour of your time on a holiday, and it will be airing on Tuesday. The Long Game is a really terrific book. Thanks for spending this much time on it with me, and I'll see you around town.
Thanks a lot, Hugh. See you later.
Thank you, Senator.